Hello, fellow Kentuckians and other friends, and welcome to a new edition of my Old Kentucky Podcast. My name is Robert Connie, and joining me, as always, is Jasmine Smith. Jasmine, how are you today?
I'm doing well, Robert. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Today on the show, we have Dr. Lisa Wilner, a candidate for the Kentucky House of Representatives in District 35. She won a very highly contested primary and is now facing nominal opposition from Republicans to be House of Representatives member from Central Jefferson County. We were really excited to speak with her. She's a very impressive person. She's a PhD in psychology. She works for the Kentucky Psychological Association, and she's on the JCPS school board. She does a ton of stuff. I really enjoyed the conversation. It went really well.
Yeah, I did too.
But before we talk to her, we have lots of other stuff to talk about. There is a very critical audit of Kentucky Wire that came out last week. We want to talk about that. Jasmine's going to talk to us a little bit about a lawsuit involving abortion that happened in federal courts involving Kentucky. We also have some other stories about Amy McGrath and a dental professor at UK that we want to get to, and we have some short quick hits. So, without any further ado, let's get to Kentucky Wired. Jasmine, before we get started too much, we made a senatorial debate like appearance. We got talked about.
Sort of, right?
Yeah.
Did we get specifically mentioned? I don't think.
We did.
We did?
Twice. Yes.
Oh, okay.
Apparently, Senator Will Schroeder, a Republican from Northern Kentucky who's running against Rachel Roberts, friend of the show, tried to use her support of HB 29 against her. So the Republicans are not down with tax reform, apparently. So that's kind of crazy. But yeah, if anybody from Northern Kentucky is listening because they heard about us from Senator Will Schroeder, welcome, I suppose. We that was kind of an interesting thing that happened. But anyways, let's talk a little bit about Kentucky Wired and the audit from the Kentucky Auditor's Office. So on September 27th, Kentucky Auditor Mike Harmon released his office's long-awaited audit of Kentucky Wired, the plan to build the middle-mile broadband infrastructure in all 120 counties. Jasmine, we've talked about Kentucky Wired at length before. You know what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah, you did a whole segment on it.
Yeah. And right, so it's the middle mile. It was a big project that the Beshear administration got kicked off. It was kind of unclear what would happen to it in the Bevin administration, although they have continued to fund it. But there was this big audit of several of the problems that have come up with Kentucky Wired, and this was a very critical audit. There were several tough pieces, but I think maybe the biggest problem that the audit uncovered were the estimates related to what are called availability payments. Availability payments are contractual payments to private vendors to build and maintain the infrastructure that would make up Kentucky Wired. Of course, Jasmine, because not much of this has actually been built, there isn't much to maintain, but because of the contracting, the way that the contracts were written, the contracts still have to be paid, so these private vendors are still being paid to mostly just be available to do...
They're like on retainer.
Right, exactly. The cost overruns in the project run to about $100 million. Jasmine, $100 million, no matter what you're spending, is a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the funding for the project was supposed to be what's called a public-private partnership, which means that there's some public money, some public funding, public financing made available, and the private sector also would provide significant funding. But the audit has found that the taxpayers are responsible for like 93% of the cost.
Which is real high, right?
Well, you know, a lot of public projects are 100% publicly
True.
Funded. And I'll get to my thoughts about this in a second. But yeah, essentially, we're operating as a public project for this. So that's basically what the audit uncovered with that. Another major finding in the audit is that the project depended heavily on its ability to sell excess capacity on the network to remain financially viable. So we talked a lot about like the K-12, like using schools and libraries to fund this project. But one of the things that the project is using to say it will be financially viable with all the costs is that excess capacity that is on the network, so you know the stuff that isn't getting used, that they could sell that, and that would make the project more financially viable. And the state projects $1.9 billion in revenue for the project, which is like they expect it to have the lifespan of about 30 years. But finding 9 actually in the audit lays out the problem with the projection of $1.9 billion, which includes that the revenue model that they used to come up with that figure calls for consistently increasing wholesale prices. The lack of an update to the revenue model, even after a lot of changes were made to the program, and the potential need to share the revenue with private partners, And finally, the fact that the revenue projections were often disclaimed throughout the entire process of bidding this out. So there's some significant problems with a $1.9 billion figure, and there's some issues. But, you know, some of these may not be as big a deal. I mean, internet, I don't know how you're – we actually just talked about your internet bill before the show. But my internet bill always goes up. So, you know, constantly increasing prices might not be necessarily a bad assumption. There wasn't too much detail about exactly who would have to share the revenue, but the disclaimed – the disclaimers throughout the process do kind of speak to the fact that this is a little bit of a hit or miss type situation, and projecting a number like that will probably miss in either direction. To me, the looming issue over this entire project is the viability of the K-12 revenue stream. So we talked about this significantly in the past. If you listen to our original show, you'll remember that the revenue from K-12 systems was supposed to pay for Kentucky Wired, with, you know, instead of paying broadband to like AT&T or whoever was the provider of internet for the schools and libraries, they would instead pay for internet to Kentucky Wired and be able to, you know, cut out this private company in the middle. We, as Kentucky taxpayers, would be able to keep more of our own money. We'd be using the money that we use to fund schools to actually also fund this project, because schools are going to pay that money for internet anyway, and it made a lot of sense. But one of the things that has come up as a problem is that K-12 systems pay for their internet through something that's called E-Rate. E-Rate is a federal program which reimburses much of the cost related to IT for school systems and libraries. However, there's some doubt that Kentucky Wired would be E-Rate eligible. So the system through which school systems get federal money to pay for internet may not even be able to be paid to Kentucky Wired, which that would blow a huge hole in the financial viability of Kentucky Wired. So first of all, AT&T is a huge opponent of Kentucky Wired getting all this money related to schools' IT systems, because they're a big provider of these services currently, and they've kind of been leading the charge to say, hey, there's some problems and there's some serious conflicts of interest that go into bidding this, because a lot of times you want to have a fair bidding process and pay the lowest price.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that doesn't necessarily always have to be the way it works. So I don't know what will happen. The audit does find that there would be massive deficits in required availability payments without K-12 revenue. So basically, there was one of the big charts that Mike Harmon had behind him as he was presenting this audit was this like bar chart. And there were these like little black bars that were mostly centered around zero, with some that were negative and some that were positive, and then these really big, scary red bars that were below zero. And he said, you know, these red bars represent what the funding would look like, the financial model would look like without the K-12 money. And these black bars that mostly center around zero are what it looks like if we actually get the K-12 money. Mostly break-even costs with some overall negative. Okay, all in all, Jasmine, this audit is bad. It's not great. But one of the things the audit also pointed out was that the train is mostly already moving down the tracks. The audit makes the case for more oversight on the project, but it doesn't call for the project's cancellation. Jasmine, my biggest takeaway from this is that this is really a cautionary tale about how public-private partnerships typically like socialize losses and make it so that taxpayers have to pay for losses and privatize gains. So like any benefit that we would have would go into private hands. So we looked at that 93% figure, which is what, you know, the public is paying for this. Mm-hmm. If we had kept that at 100%, we would be able to, you know, socialize, keep all the gains and handle all the losses without having to mess with any sort of like private contracts and having to entangle
right.
ourselves further. So, you know, private partnerships do allow us to do a bunch of cool stuff, and they give us cover because the sticker price is a little bit lower, but they do have some problems later on in their contracting. So that's something to keep in mind as we do more of this going forward. The whole audit is available. It'll be linked in the newsletter, so make sure you get that. But yeah, that's my review of it. Jasmine, tell us about this abortion lawsuit.
All right. Federal Judge Greg Stavers last week struck down a law that required Kentucky's abortion providers to have transfer agreements in place with hospitals in order to operate. So basically what a transfer agreement means is that the clinic would have to have these contracts with hospitals for ambulance services for emergencies. The governor filed a lawsuit to try to shut down the one abortion provider in the state, the EMW clinic in Louisville, because they didn't have proper transfer agreements in place, right?
Right. And there was a law that was passed that said that they had to have these transfer agreements, but there is some dubious, it's dubious as to whether those are actually medically necessary.
Right. And so this ruling allows the EMW Surgical Center to remain open as Kentucky's last abortion clinic
right.
for now. The government will be appealing to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. The state of Ohio, their Supreme Court upheld a similar bill back in February. And another note about the Sixth Circuit, Bevin's appeal on the ultrasound law that was struck down is already before the Sixth Circuit, and oral arguments were heard in that case in July. Right. So we'll have a few different abortion restriction bills going to the Court of Appeals. So basically, the governor's attorney, besides the more substantive constitutional arguments, they also raised some standing arguments to no avail. They were arguing that Planned Parenthood didn't have standing to sue to try to argue that this law is unconstitutional, but they have third-party standing. So there is a ton of case law that talks about physicians and that physicians have this unique third-party standing where certain laws will certainly affect their practice and their patients. So Planned Parenthood has standing. That argument was a no-go for the government. Judge Stivers found that the law posed an undue burden on women seeking abortions. And so this standard, we've talked about this before when we've talked about abortion bills, comes from a Supreme Court case called Planned Parenthood versus Casey. The test is essentially two parts. First, there's the legitimate interest test. So the state has to be advancing a legitimate interest to pass a restriction on abortion. So if you're the state, you are saying that your legitimate interest is women's health, right? You're saying this is for the health of the woman in case there's an emergency. This is for public health and safety. That's the guise that you're going to put your legitimate interest under. However, Judge Stivers said this did not meet the legitimate interest test because this specific restriction was not medically necessary.
Right.
So doesn't meet that first test. And then there's the other test is the undue burden. An abortion restriction cannot pose an undue burden on the woman seeking an abortion. And they said this poses an undue burden. So they struck the law down as unconstitutional as applied to Planned Parenthood.
I wonder, you know, because EMW is the last standing Kentucky abortion clinic, I wonder, you know, if we were in a different situation where there were like four abortion clinics, like, and maybe there was one next door that had a transfer agreement, if that, you know, undue burden would not have come into play as much.
Right. And so there are two types of constitutional challenges. There's as applied challenges. So a law is unconstitutional as applied to this certain person or entity, right? Okay. And then there's facial challenges. And a facial challenge is, on its face, this law is unconstitutional. Planned Parenthood won on the as-applied challenge, so the facial challenge is kind of a moot issue. But you may be right, you know?
Yeah, like you always say, judges are loath to actually issue these broad readings of, overturning law. They want to keep it pretty narrow, right?
Right, but this is a huge win, but we'll see what happens at the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. Mm-hmm. And in addition, the government owes Planned Parenthood $20,000 because they no-showed a deposition, and they want to fight that, too. They're upset.
I'm excited.
About
my tax.
That. I don't know.
My tax dollars are going to support Planned Parenthood. There you go.
Exactly.
That's so interesting. So you talked about the Ohio Supreme Court that upheld a similar law. But if I'm remembering correctly, and I believe this is the case, Ohio Supreme Court's elected. So that's...
Right, and that's the state court, and this is a federal district court lawsuit.
Right. And those federal judges are appointed by presidents who are elected by the whole country versus the state of Ohio's Supreme Court voters, which that can, you know, of course, abortion's a political issue up and down the aisle. But that could be a different environment entirely. Yeah. All right, Jasmine, let's talk for a second about the a fired UK dental professor, which that seems like a weird topic, doesn't it?
Yeah,
I'm
excited to hear about it.
Okay, so back in August, this man named Dr. Rainer Mullins, he filed a lawsuit against several members of the University of Kentucky's administration and a member of the Bevin administration. Dr. Mullins alleges that he was terminated because of critical comments that he submitted to CMS that opposed Governor Bevin's 1115 waiver. So we've talked extensively about the 1115 waiver, but in case you needed to know, that's Kentucky Health. It would change the way that Kentucky does its Medicaid expansion and basically make it so that fewer people qualify. I think that's that is maybe not the most generous way I can say it, but that is a short way to say what the 1115 waiver is. Dr. Mullins was a faculty member with the University of Kentucky College of Dentistry, and he'd formerly been the chair of the Department of Community Dentistry and has worked in public health dentistry. So, Jasmine, in case you didn't know, dentistry is actually a really important and often overlooked aspect of public health. People's teeth oftentimes determine their entire life's quality, which is weird to think about. But for anybody listening who doesn't go to the dentist, you should go. It's good for you. So in the period before he was fired, Dr. Mullins worked as an emeritus faculty, meaning that he was retired, but he was still working some. He was kind of working on contract, doing a few things for UK, maybe teaching some classes, maybe doing some research. I'm not sure, but he was an emeritus faculty. The story Dr. Mullins tells in his lawsuit is that someone in the Bevin administration, who's called just John Doe in the lawsuit, somebody in the Bevin administration called Dr. Mark Birdwhistle. And Dr. Mark Birdwhistle either was or is, I don't know if he's still there. He, at that time, was working in the Bevin administration on the waiver. So Dr. Mark Birdwhistle, who was working on the waiver, was called by someone in the Bevin administration, and they expressed displeasure with Dr. Mullins. Dr. Birdwhistle allegedly then called a man named Stefanos Kirkinides. It's a Greek name, and I can't quite remember. I think it's Kirkinides. But anyways, this man, Dr. Kirkinides, is the dean of UK's College of Dentistry. When he was called by Dr. Birdwhistle in July 2016, and Dr. Birdwhistle expressed his displeasure with Dr. Mullins and asked Dr. Kirkinides to apply pressure to retaliate against him. That's what's being alleged in this lawsuit. And then by January 2017, Dr. Mullins was informed that his appointment with the College of Dentistry would not be renewed. So he's an emeritus faculty, he's kind of working on contract, and he was told after all this happened that his contract would not be renewed. So why we're talking about this is that this week, a federal judge ruled that the lawsuit could indeed move to a jury trial. The date is set for November 6th, early next month. The Bevin administration and UK had been moving to have the lawsuit thrown out, but the judge ruled that there was indeed enough evidence to move forward. And I'm sure there's a term for that, but I don't know what it is. So
it probably means that a motion for a summary judgment got denied.
That's probably what it is.
They probably made motions to dismiss based on all kinds of other things, too.
Right. It's kind of interesting. I mean, I think it's an interesting story because it's kind of it's a corruption story, right? Governor Bevin pushing to have somebody fired from their position because of their opposition to his Medicaid waiver. As a politician, as a government official, you shouldn't have people fired for political reasons. That's not great. Who knows how a jury will find? Governor Bevin's not very popular right now, I don't think. So, but it would be interesting to see how it all comes down against UK and the College of Dentistry. So we'll see how it goes. Jasmine, another quick story before we go to our actual quick hits. Amy McGrath, Lieutenant Colonel Amy McGrath, who's again running for the United States 6th Congressional District, which centers around Lexington, she posted a massive $3.65 million quarter this time in her fundraising. That's a huge amount of money for any office, basically outside of somebody running for president in the general election. Like right. Some of these lower tiered presidential contenders, like the 14th or 15th person on the list, they would have trouble raising $3.65 million. And as a House person, that's a lot of money. And as a House person in Kentucky, that's a ton of money. So FEC reports are not actually due until October 15th. On October 15th, we'll have a much clearer picture about how everyone else did. But right now, we don't have anything to actually compare this number to. But if candidates have a particularly big quarter, they usually share about it ahead of time. So, you know, you can say, oh my gosh, we raised $8 billion this quarter. And you would just push out a press release and be like, the report is forthcoming. And that's basically what we have here. The only other candidate before I started looking at this which was like the day after the quarter ended at the end of September. The only other candidate who I saw who released numbers near to this is Josh Harder, who's a Democrat running in California's 10th district, which is a Republican district kind of similar to the 6th, who raised $3.5 million. So Amy McGrath actually beat Mr. Harder. Amy McGrath raised this money from 32,000 donors, apparently, which is a ton. And their campaign has $1.7 million in the bank to actually use before the end of the election. So $3.65 million, but that also just went to cover expenses a lot of the time. There's still a lot left over, though. So during the second quarter, McGrath raised only $989,000, so less than $1 million, and now they've raised like almost $4 million. And Andy Barr in the second quarter raised $711,000. So the thing about third quarters, especially third quarters right before an election, they're usually really big. This is the last time you get a number
right,
out.
It's like the big push.
It's the big push. I mean, they will continue to push and push for the fourth quarter, but this is the last chance you have to report a number to really freak mm-hmm. everybody out. That happened, and so we will see what Andy Barr raised in the middle of this month. So in Roll Call, which is a political magazine, newspaper-type deal, really popular in Washington, campaign manager for Amy McGrath, Mark Nicholas, he said that the giving was, quote, constant and steady, unquote. And there wasn't really a particular fundraiser that led to this charge. So sometimes people were like, oh, we had a big reaction. Like the first time, when she first came on the scene and raised a bunch of money, they kind of said, oh, there was a big reaction to this ad we had, this introduction ad, and people gave money to us. They're like, no, there wasn't really anything in particular. People just like us, so they gave us money. So when the FEC reports are released, we will definitely delve into the information about the report, such as where the donors are from and the size of the contributions. There will be a lot from outside of Kentucky, but probably a lot of small dollar people. I mean, Amy McGrath's a pretty inspiring person to a lot of people, I think. So
she is, and she's a great speaker, and she's been everywhere. You know, you see her in all these communities in her district. Yeah. So that's a lot of money.
She was even on my old Kentucky podcast.
She was.
Very briefly, yes. All right, Jasmine, before we get out of here and listen to our interview with Dr. Lisa Wilner, let's talk about some quick hits. Yeah. All right, first of all, the Kentucky Board of Education has named Wayne Lewis its permanent executive director. Mr. Lewis has been acting like only as an interim. We've talked about him at length about the JCPS takeover, but Mr. Lewis had only been acting as an interim. The board elevated him to the permanent position on Tuesday without a national search of any variety. So they didn't actually go out looking for anybody. They elevated Wayne Lewis, made him the interim, and then just made him the chair. Jasmine, a lot of people are upset that there wasn't a national search. I saw Andy Beshear put out from his campaign account, like, this, we're disappointed there wasn't a national search type deal. But to me, it was pretty clear that even if they had, the position was basically Lewis's to lose. I mean, if you kind of already know who you're going to hire, I don't know the value of doing a national search. I think about that in terms of, like, football coaches and university presidents. And this, too, I don't think Dr. Lewis deserves this job, and I don't think I think he literally stole it from another person, and that's a little disappointing, but this move makes sense to me, given where they're at. So
yeah,
here you go. Okay, another thing. Attorney General Andy Beshear has appointed an independent counsel to investigate Jared Deering's allegations against Allison Lunnergan Grimes. If that's a sentence that's confusing to you, you should go back to listen to a couple shows ago. The executive director of the Kentucky Board of Elections, Jared Deering, made several allegations against Allison Lunnergan Grimes, both as accessing a database that he didn't think she should have access to, and of creating a toxic work environment. So the AG's office appointed an independent counsel in order to, quote, ensure a fair process for everyone, unquote. This would be really awkward for Andy Beshear to investigate Grimes because they're potentially opponents in the governor's race, and you don't want, like,
right. Exactly.
I mean, nobody would believe what that report had to say if it was Andy Beshear talking about Allison Lunnergan Grimes. So he's put out an independent counsel. Jasmine, two quick hits about Governor Bevin. The first is that he is raising money for his wife's charity by letting the public determine what to do with his facial hair.
I saw that today. There are a lot of interesting options.
Yeah.
If that's something you care about,
I would like to see.
There's going to be a link in the newsletter for how you can do that.
Yeah, I would like to see the governor go with the Anchorman, is what he had. He had several different options.
That's the Ron Burgundy just mustache.
Yeah, like the right? Weird mustache looking situation. The Samson, like letting it continue, that's a biblical allusion. Like there's other ways to say full beard, but he said the Samson, which would be like the full beard. I also like that one. An interesting way to go about doing it. A lot of people were like mad at him, but I'm like, who cares? Like, this is not a big deal.
Yeah, I don't care at all.
Right. I mean, if it raises money for a charity, who, like, even if it's a stupid charity, which it's not, like, whatever, who cares?
Completely indifferent.
Right. Yeah. But I did think it was funny. Okay. And lastly, Governor Matt Bevin's transition team website. So after he won the election, he created a transition team website to kind of talk about the things he wanted to do once he was governor. That website has been taken over by anime pornography. So
it like got hacked, and that's what it is now?
That's what it is now.
Is it still there as of today?
I didn't check.
You haven't checked it out?
Go check it out. No. No. I saw this in a tweet from Joe Sanka yesterday, and the Courier Journal wrote a story about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, so I saw it yesterday.
It's too bad he doesn't know anybody that could act as like a nice like CIO for this sort of thing. You know? All right. Anyways, that's enough of that. I hope you guys enjoyed it. We will now talk to Dr. Lisa Wilner.
Dr. Lisa Wilner is the Democratic nominee for the Kentucky House of Representatives in the 35th District in Louisville, which covers a narrow band of central Jefferson County stretching from Oak Street in the north to slightly south of the Gene Snyder Freeway. The district covers all of Audubon Park and much of Germantown and Okolona. Dr. Wilner is currently the executive director of the Kentucky Psychological Association and a member of the JCPS School Board, which we talk a lot about here on the show. She holds a PhD from the California School of Professional Psychology. So, Dr. Wilner, welcome to My Old Kentucky Podcast.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here with you.
Great. So you are attempting to make the jump from school board to state legislature. So the JCPS School Board has several members who are progressive people, and it would seem that a person with your political beliefs might have more ability to lead changes in policy at the school board level than in the state legislature, where Republicans have a large majority and the Democratic caucus has some pretty conservative members as well. Why did you decide to run for this office instead of re-election to the school board?
Well, first of all, I think we need to change the balance in the House.
Sure.
Yeah.
So that's number one. I have tremendous respect for my colleagues on the school board. I'm really proud of some of the work we've been able to get done. Mm-hmm. Some of my contributions I feel really so positive about, that we were able to broaden the non-discrimination policies to include gender expression and gender identity, that we were able to have a more humane discipline policy. And so there's a lot of good work still to be done. Mm-hmm. However, from the seat on the school board, you recognize how much really is controlled by what happens in Frankfurt.
Sure.
And so it just seemed like I needed to move my advocacy for public education and other issues just further upstream.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and even after you already made the decision to run, you really saw how much
right.
Frankfurt could control
yes.
what happens, right?
For sure, yeah. Yep.
Back in May, you won a hotly contested primary by a wide margin. I was at least surprised to see that you earned 57% of the vote, more than a majority in a three-way race, and your closest opponent got 29%. So were you as surprised as I was, and what do you credit the win to?
To be honest, I'm really not focused on the horse race aspect mm-hmm. of the campaign. I was just focused on working my plan, mm-hmm. and it was a very simple campaign plan, and it was simply to connect with as many voters one-on-one as possible and to have meaningful conversations with folks in the district and to listen carefully to their concerns. Mm-hmm. So I started walking door to door on November 4th, mm-hmm. Took off Christmas Day, took off Easter, and that was about it.
Mm-hmm.
Covered the district four times, had a tremendous grassroots following. Mm-hmm. Folks in the district, I'd meet at their door, and then they'd say, how can I help?
Mm-hmm.
And the response at the doors was tremendous.
Mm-hmm.
So it felt to me like my message, my issues, were really resonating with the voters of mm-hmm. the 35th. As far as the margin, you know, honestly, I never gave it a thought.
Wow. Okay, well, yeah, I mean, following up on that, you know, not paying attention to the horse race or, you know, how all that's going, you know, in the general election, you're technically contested, but it doesn't look like your opponent is running, like, too much of a race. So tell us how and if that impacts what you're doing and really what you're doing in terms of campaigning for the fall election.
So I'm taking nothing for granted. Mm-hmm. Again, not paying attention to the horse race, just paying attention to connecting with voters.
Mm-hmm.
So continuing the door-to-door, continuing to have great volunteer response, continuing to, now that voters know me a little better, I'm hearing a lot of from folks directly by email or on my cell phone, but just continuing to connect and to listen and to get the word out.
Yeah.
So really, no change.
No. Yeah, that's good to hear, too, because, I mean, the more that you can hear from voters, it's good, and I really think that state representatives are in a unique position to kind of organize their districts and to kind of figure out what that district needs to move forward in Frankfurt. So that's good to hear.
I agree with you 100%. Mm-hmm. Got to stay in touch with the voters. Mm-hmm. And also, we need to be paying attention to the Democratic ticket all the way up and down.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You're running to succeed Representative Jim Wayne in the 35th District. We love Representative Wayne here on My Old Kentucky Podcast, and so do a lot of other people across the state. In what ways do you think that your service will remind your constituents of Representative Wayne? And in what ways do you think that you might differ from him?
Well, first of all, I also love Jim Wayne. He's been my state rep for a good long time. I have canvassed for him. I've driven folks to the polls for him. Used to take youth groups to see him to talk about the Stream Saver Bill and other environmental issues that he was so focused on. He's a great representative, and it's going to be a loss. He's been an important voice in the House. Mm-hmm. So I think what I... and what others, among other things, admire about Representative Wayne is his compassion and his integrity. And those are values very near and dear to my heart and core values of mine. And I hope that voters in the district and constituents in the district will recognize those same qualities in me. How I'm different, you know, we're two different people. We have two different sets of experiences. And Jim has been outspoken for years that we need more representation by women in the House. And I appreciate his perspective on that. And I do think, you know, having been a daughter and a sister and a wife and a mother and just navigating one's way in the world as a female human changes one's perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. It absolutely does. So you received significant support in your race from Representative Mary Lou Marzian, who represents the 34th District in Louisville next door to your district. And then she's actually my representative. And she's known as, well, by me and I think by others, as a very strident representative who fights very hard for her beliefs. And I think sometimes that comes at the expense of future compromises. Sometimes she's not afraid to go there a lot of the time. In Frankfort, do you see yourself acting in that mode or as more of like a consensus builder?
So Mary Lou is a valiant champion for the causes she believes in.
Absolutely, yes.
Absolutely, and I respect and admire that so much. Her Viagra bill was, right. you know, a stroke of genius.
She's done that so many times throughout the years, and I laugh every time. It's very good.
Yes, it's fabulous. And, you know, one of the causes that Mary Lou is a valiant champion for is to have more progressive women by her side in Frankfort. And so Mary Lou and I have that in common. Having said that, we have very different personalities, we have very different styles, we're different people, and anyone who's familiar at all with my work on the school board knows that I'm not strident, and that I am a bridge builder, a consensus builder.
Great.
So we've talked extensively on our show about the attempt by the Kentucky Board of Education to take over the JCPS school board. You had a really up-close view of the negotiations between JCPS and the state, and in the end, you voted against the settlement. So we're interested to hear, why did you vote the way that you did?
I did vote against the settlement. I have to say that I was not categorically opposed to reaching a settlement agreement. It had to be the right agreement. And it was really a dialogue. There were several different iterations of the agreement that went back and forth and back and forth. And what finally came to us and was, you know, approved by four board members, I felt like we weren't quite there yet. And I've been kind of holding my breath for the final corrective action plan to see what was in that. And, you know, there are some, I think, still causes for concern, and I hope that folks will stay vigilant and aware and tuned in. Having said that, I think it's a tremendous relief that state takeover is off the table for 2 years. I'm very glad to have that behind us, but we can't take our eyes off the ball.
Just as a follow-up to that, were there any specific concerns you had about it? Is there something specific that you felt like shouldn't have been in there that you are concerned about, or was it just the settlement in general?
I think that we could have ceded a little less authority with regard to the corrective action plan. We really didn't know what was going to be in that. So that had the possibility of being a Trojan horse.
Right.
And I think we dodged a bullet. I think where there's still some concern is that there are not real clear outcome metrics. And so in 2 years, when they can do another audit, if the same folks are still running the show, you know, how clear have we laid out what it means for us to be successful?
Right.
Okay. JCPS, though, is not the only school system that the Kentucky Board of Education has voted to take over in the past. So do you disagree with the idea of a state take over as a matter of principle, or do you think it's sometimes appropriate for the state to take over a school district?
I do think that it's sometimes appropriate. I mean, there was one county in Kentucky where the superintendent was found guilty of vote buying.
Right.
yeah, you know, that's not great.
That's not a good thing. So, you know, in cases of fraud and just outright mismanagement, you know, absolutely there's a role for the state.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it should always be the lesser intervention first.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see how it goes with assistance before leaping directly to pure takeover.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I mean, I think JCPS too, and maybe Fayette County are kind of unique in their stature, because I mean, JCPS, I believe, is the second largest budget in the entire state behind the state itself.
Correct.
So yeah, that it's going to be tough for them. It would have been, I have no idea how that would have worked. So I'm glad it didn't happen.
And I'm convinced that they didn't have any idea how it was going to work either.
Right. Exactly. So we have asked every candidate that we've spoken to this year about Kentucky's budget. You know, of course, the budget process in 2018 was hopelessly broken and revealed some really significant problems, the ways in which that we as Kentuckians are governed. So what are some ways that you hope the legislature moves to fix both the content of the budget and the process by which it's passed?
So this is, you mentioned Jim Wayne earlier, and of course, he's just been a champion mm-hmm. on these issues, that there needs to be transparency, we need to follow process, there needs to just be good government, mm-hmm. pure and simple. There needs to be transparency, and we need to follow the rules that are already there. So that's number one. So Jim Wayne has also championed legislation that would turn this upside down budget right side up. And a lot of the Democrats have been co-sponsors on that piece of legislation. And I think that's exactly right. We have corporations and the wealthiest Kentuckians paying a smaller portion than regular old middle class, working class, and in sometimes, you know, really struggling families are paying a much larger portion. And that's just not fair.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the bill that you're talking about here is HB 29,
yes.
which is the tax reform bill that that Representative Wayne has sponsored, you know, since the Blue Ribbon Commission that Governor Beshear put together. When that bill goes back in front of the legislature next year, would you be willing to act as a co-sponsor to it?
Absolutely. I can't wait to be a co-sponsor to that bill.
All right.
So we've just talked a little bit about budget reform and some education stuff. What are other issues that you're particularly passionate about?
Well, I'm a licensed psychologist, and I work for the Kentucky Psychological Association. We have 1 in 4 Kentuckians with mental health issues.
Mm-hmm.
So that means that mental health affects every Kentuckian, because we all know someone or have someone very close to us struggling with these issues. So health care reform, maintaining the Medicaid expansion, maintaining parity with mental health care as well as health care needs to be accessible to every Kentuckian. So I feel so strongly about that. Also feel very strongly about the pension mm-hmm. issues that folks who've been public employees for our state have built our state, have protected our state, have educated our mm-hmm. state, deserve to have their contract upheld.
Mm-hmm.
So very, very strong on those issues.
So you're actually, you know, I think you're the first person that's actually mentioned the pension issue as like something they're specifically interested in. And that's an issue that Republicans, I feel like, think that they have an advantage on. In what ways would you like to see like a more progressive pension reform?
Well, I think, you know, there was reform in 2013 mm-hmm. that's actually working.
Right.
And so I think there's been a lot of obfuscation of what that reform was and how we are starting, if we stick with that, how we are starting to right the ship a mm-hmm. little bit. So I think that we're missing the boat, and I think the Democrats have not done a great job of communicating that message.
Well, my poor state senator is out there like trying to tell everybody he can about how the 2013 reforms fixed the problem, but I, you know, hopefully more people listen. So
absolutely.
Yeah.
And you know, you're definitely not the first candidate that we've interviewed that's talked about mental health. So I know Tina Bojanowski's really passionate about that too. So maybe you'll have some other legislators on board with you to co-sponsor legislation about that.
There is a great slate of Democratic candidates running in Jefferson
yeah,
County
they really are.
And across the state, mm-hmm. actually. And I am very excited about the possibility of serving alongside Tina Bojanowski and others and getting some real work done for real Kentuckians.
Absolutely.
Awesome. And finally, Dr. Wilner, how can people get involved with your campaign?
Oh, what a great question. You can contact me through my website. It's lisawillner.com, LISAWILLNER.com, and go to sign up. Our volunteer coordinator will get in touch with you, and we would love to have you involved in this project.
All right, great. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me. What a treat.
Jasmine, how can people get a hold of us?
They can find us on Twitter at @MyOldKYPod. We have a Facebook page that you can like. You can now get our show notes and other information in our newsletter that we send out weekly. That's at tinyletter.com/MyOldKentuckyNewsletter. And we have a Patreon page that you can subscribe to. You can subscribe for as little as $1 a month, or you can give more to support what we do. And maybe one day we'll be mentioned in more debates because of your Patreon support. And you can do that at patreon.com/MyOldKentuckyPodcast.
All right, everybody. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next week.